This is the Meat Eater Podcast coming at you shirtless, severely bug bitten, and in my case, underwearless.
We hunt the Meat Eater Podcast.
You can't predict anything.
First off, what'd you guys think about that that mountain lion meat from last night?
Very good.
Yeah, I thought it was delicious.
Cougar meat.
Yeah.
Very good.
Even my mother-in-law ate it.
Yeah. I was surprised how tender it was.
That recipe, well, it's a, you know the chef Jacques Pepin?
Mm-hmm.
I call him Jack Pepin.
Oh, yeah.
He, that's his little sauce. Well, Chinese five spice powder sauce, but I like fupled it, which is even more than quadrupling it. And he does it with pork.
Uh-huh.
And just, you know, kind of braises it for a little teeny bit in the oven. But I like, with that cougar meat, except for the loins, that cougar meat, you got to waylay it with some long cooking.
Yeah, because we did that.
Because that's just like a roast.
We did that loin for that one dinner, and it was a little dry.
Yeah.
We grilled it.
Yeah.
And it was a little dry.
Now, the part of the loin that has the fat on it is different, because the fat on the lion fat is good.
Mm-hmm.
Real good.
Yeah, I almost felt like, between all the chunks that I had and I've eaten over the last year, that I didn't like the backstrap as much, the loin.
You liked that roast last night, didn't you?
Well, yeah, because it has just more fat incorporated in it.
That was a fatty hunk.
That you're getting to use, where that backstrap is very, very lean, you know? And it's just like, no matter how you braise it or do whatever, if you braise a fatty piece of meat and you braise that lean loin, the lean loin still tastes drier. It's drier in your mouth, you know? You can sop it with sauce as much as you want, right?
Yep.
It definitely benefited from that long, slow cook.
Well, you'll notice that when, like, in my slow cooker, it was only the sauce in there, which is, like, Chinese five-spice powder, soy, ketchup, ginger, garlic, sherry vinegar. That sauce only came up like a third the way on that roast, which is probably like a 3-pound hunk of a lion's back leg. And I flipped it a couple times in there. Then the end mashed it up. Not mashed up, but broke it apart so that it all took a little bath toward the end, so that it all had a little sauce bath.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was good.
It's good, man. I like it. And then, impressions about squidding. Well, you've squidded.
Yeah.
You've squidded.
I've been down there a couple times.
First timer.
First time squidder.
Yeah.
When you say you, that was Andy Radulowski.
Oh, I haven't done intros yet. We're joined by Chef Andrew Radulowski, who I have known for a bazillion years. And real quick before we get to that, I want to touch on me and Andy's first wild game meal. Only kind of a wild game meal. We were having like a little party. Back in the, probably around 1995, 1996, we were throwing a party because we were living in the same sort of weird flop house. We were living in a house that had four people living in it, none of whom were on the lease. Like, this house had a very, like, a constantly evolving sort of cast of characters who lived there.
Yeah, there's many people went through that place.
Yeah. And we borrowed a pig roaster from my mom's neighbor, I think.
Or was it?
I think I borrowed it.
Yeah, you did borrow it.
I had to like drag it an hour to where we lived. And then we had a pig, like we were getting a whole pig. But then me and my brother were out fishing steelhead or salmon. Was it the fall? It was the fall. We were coming back from fishing salmon up on the Pierre Marquette River. And the dude in front of us ran a deer over. He didn't want it. So we took the whole deer and then drove it a couple hours down to Grand Rapids. Cut the deer up in the garage, and then sewed the whole deer with baling wire inside the pig.
Yeah. And it came out phenomenal.
Unbelievable, man. Unbelievable. Like, pork fat basted deer hunks. That was me and Poots.
That must have been a pretty big pig.
Oh, it was a big pig. Yeah, we fit the whole deer in it. I can't remember, we boned it. Like, we boned a lot of it out.
Yeah, it was in pieces, I think.
Yeah.
But we got most of it in there.
Crammed in there, sewed it up with wire.
But the funny thing is this all happened right on the corner of a very busy intersection in the middle of Grand Rapids.
Who was the instigator?
With the party?
with the pig turducken situation?
I don't know. We just had a. We were already cooking a pig, and then we picked up a roadkill deer. And
well, that's the key to the situation is having somebody who's like, "Yes, I will follow through with your stupid idea."
I have no recollection. Did we wrap something in hog wire too?
Yeah,
or chicken wire? Did we roll that pig up in chicken wire?
No, because it was in a roaster. I think we just put that chunked up deer in there and just sewed it shut.
Yeah, sewed it shut with baling wire
and threw it in a roaster.
What happened was, see, I want to tell the story, but I don't want to reveal my preferred alias that I use anytime I have to have a social media account. So I can't reveal my preferred alias. Anyways, we heard in our neighborhood, we heard that you could block off your road in order to have a family reunion.
Basically, we were trying to elude getting the party broken up by the cops.
So we thought, like, oh, we'll register as a family reunion. We just use the name from The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. But that never registered it anyways. So anyways, that's how far me and Andy go back. But you were going to say, yeah, so Andy is squidded because you're a Pacific Northwesterner.
Yeah.
Well, you've done a bit of squidding.
For the last 20 years.
20 years.
Yeah.
Andy lives out on a lonely little island called San Juan Island. Where he catches fish and cooks. And then we'll touch on that some more. Cal, initial impressions of squid jigging?
Loved it, man. I mean, the whole scene. Like, the whole Asian community down there just chain smoking away and really extremely limited communication, even amongst us. And it's all about just, like, harvest and... It's dark, you know, city sounds going around and ferries moving around.
Get a contact buzz from cigarettes outside.
Yeah, and generator exhaust fumes. Yeah, that little combo. It was great, man. I loved it.
You were lucky because we kind of had a translator last night. There was, had some English?
No, I've now and then had the privilege of sitting next to, most of the guys at Jig Squidder, I did a story on this years ago for Outside, and most of the guys I interviewed, virtually all the guys I interviewed were from Vietnam, born Vietnamese, Cambodia, Laos, and the Philippines. Tends to be, I think that crew where we were, I think that crew is almost all Vietnamese that goes down there, I believe. So yeah, you don't get a lot of, it's hard to, you kind of can hack your way through some communication. But now and then I've been next to guys who speak pretty good English, then you can sort of get the inside scoop.
Well, I just don't, you know, like most little, like if I kept relating it to being on like a busy steelhead river. I mean, for the most part, generalization for sure, but for the most part, if you are willing to communicate with somebody, it is possible, but you're still not going to exchange information. It's like, oh, what color, whatever are you running? How far down are you? Most guys aren't going to tell you exactly what they're, you know, consistently hooking up on. And it'd be the same in the little fish and pier community that we were in last night.
But what's different there is you're not allowed any personal space on the squid pier.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was getting crowded out in that corner.
If you start tuning them, people will... I mean, it's not measured in feet. It's the amount of space you're given, like where your line hits the water, is given inches.
Yes.
People will just drop in.
I think, too, though, the difference is that, in a steelhead hole, you might be looking at, 100 fish if it's a lot in there. And a lot of times it could be a few. There we're talking about thousands of squid.
Probably tens of thousands of squids.
Really? You think it's that many?
I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know.
It's a pile of them.
And
when the school comes through, I mean, it's got to be.
I mean, just looking at a few quick online photos of like, squid mating. It's, yeah.
Okay.
Big globs.
But yeah, I mean, and you're still like fishing into the abyss, right? You have your big bright light, but that doesn't do anything for the angler's vision at all. It's like you're just illuminating murky, you know, zero visibility water.
Yeah, you're running like a 20,000 lumen light, but you still got to use a headlamp to tie a knot.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, yeah, so it's got all the things I like about fishing, you know, lots of variables to figure out. But still tons of opportunities. So.
I like the multicultural bent to it too, because I spent my whole life fishing with dudes who look just about like me.
Yeah. Yeah.
No matter where I go, there I am, you know, and it's like to fish with people who are coming, who have a completely different, like, American experience is nice, man.
Yeah. And then when that dude hauled up the crab last night, I was kind of giving him the thumbs up.
He's stoked. Like, everybody's cheering this guy on. He caught a rock crab on his squid.
Well, he was special because he had caught a rock crab two nights in a row.
Yeah, that was cool.
Just the whole scene itself. Sometimes you kind of get lost a little bit. You're kind of focusing on looking down at that water and jigging. Then all of a sudden you look up and there's a jumbo jet going over. There's a ferry. You kind of forget that you're right in that whole crazy downtown city.
We bumped into like the two business guys, older business guys on the way out.
Yeah.
Like, well, how'd you guys do? And then there's the fancy bar across the street, and it's like nobody in there.
Yeah, don't say too much because that little there's all a right. lot of well known. Yeah,
yeah,
it's
yeah,
kind
yeah.
of a little like I kind of like it.
Yeah, for sure.
And I have noticed mugs out on the piers that I feel like weren't out on the piers that long ago.
Okay, gotcha.
Like I'm afraid of from talking about it too much that you could, I feel as though that you could instigate a demographic shift.
For sure.
An unwelcome demographic shift.
For sure.
Out there.
That's where your staying power would come into play.
What do you mean?
I think folks are like, yeah, this sounds great, and just dip their toe in.
Mm. You'll get real frustrated.
Real fast, yeah.
Yeah. You got to do a lot of jigging before you start kind of getting the basics. I mean, unless you got someone standing there giving you the what's up, but you could show up and just be kind of like, what's not happening here? Because squid don't hit. Squid, it's not a hit.
Fondle.
They fondle.
Fingering.
They fondle. And it's not a hook. It's a... What you're impaling the squid on wires and he doesn't hit. He's down there fondling, toying with the thing.
But super fun. And because of all your guys' knowledge, I felt like a squid jigging pro in about 40 minutes, you know?
Oh, no. Yesterday, it was a big... I think I've been out 4 or 5 times prior to last night. And yesterday was a much different feel for being part of the Steve Rinella's squid jigging crew.
You I mean, broke through, yeah.
Yeah, that's what it felt like. It's like, okay. Steve had told me he'd sort of had a breakthrough a couple weeks ago. He caught like 49 in an hour with the two kids.
Yeah, that's with two kids, which is like less good than you do by one person.
Right.
You know, that's like that's not like 3 rods in the water. That's like 0.75 rods in the water.
Right.
Yeah, I think the first time I went out, I didn't catch any, and the dude right next to me was just one after another pulling them out. And it can be frustrating.
Dude, it makes you want to snap your rod over your knee and throw it in the water.
It's like, how? And I look at his jig, almost exact same setup, and it's like, how is this guy just pulling one after another? And I'm just sitting here.
Because he knows when a squid's looking at his jig.
Yeah. True.
He's not. That's what I was saying about like walleye last night. How they don't so much hit as look at it.
Yeah,
like that. He just like I'm st- like I understand it more and more all the time.
And I got to see the flip side of the coin last night, where when we were packing up, like a big part of that peer community came over. And they were looking in our buckets to see exactly how we did, and then they were looking at the jigs.
Mm-hmm.
It was the first time I've ever been the subject of envy. The first time I've ever been the subject of envy on a squid pier.
You can see it on their faces being like, yep, that jig is no different than mine. Yeah. Like, I love that part of
it. Yeah, it was like a 180 from the last few times. Like, there's like nobody's paying attention to us. We're just watching everybody else catch squid after squid after squid. And this time, the gal walks up, looks in our bucket. She looks at me and she's like, 7 pounds, pretty good. I was like, yeah.
Yeah, I didn't like that aspect of it, man. I like flying low out there under the radar. But Yanni, last thing I want to talk about, this is something that you brought up to me that really breaks my heart. You're saying that like...
Well, it's because you haven't let me explain myself yet.
Well, I'm giving you a chance now. Can I tee it up?
Yeah.
Yanni found out that you can buy frozen squid for about $4.50 a pound and now like squid jigging less.
No, I didn't say less.
Yeah.
You put that word in my mouth. I just said it changed, you know, like my sort of perspective about it. Because that's, you know, one thing that I enjoy, I think about whether it's fishing, hunting, or whatever, you're sort of out there getting things that maybe not everybody can put their hands on.
Right? You like the exclusivity.
Yeah. And it makes it special.
Yeah, like when you're out fishing spot prawns and those things are $40 a pound.
Mm-hmm.
Or what's a king salmon going for nowadays?
Yeah, you'd spend a lot of money. I don't know. I mean, you think about the marketing that goes into like the Copper River. I mean, that stuff comes out at what? $50, $60 a pound when the season first hits. It's unbelievable.
You like that. You like either that people can't get it, like with mountain lion. If you want to eat some mountain lion, either you got to get it or have a buddy who, right? It's hard to find.
Yeah.
But Joe Blow, anybody. Any kind of, that's the thing with saltwater fishing though. Freshwater fishing, you're catching a lot of fish that there's no way to go get it. Like there's no commercial way to get it.
Yeah, unless you're Great Lakes.
It depends on the species. So, yeah, you could be fishing lake whitefish, which you can get. You can get walleye. You can get rainbow trout. You can get lake perch, and then there's all the aquaculture fish. But there are a shitload of species that you can't go buy.
Morel mushrooms would be kind of somewhere in between.
In between. You can buy them. That's another thing. You can buy it, right?
Yeah.
So there's things that, there's game meats, like lion being a great example. There's many more. Moose, you know, that you can't purchase. There's no way to go buy it. Then you have.
Illegal.
Yeah, illegal. Just, there's no commercial market for it. So there's that. Then there's the stuff that anyone could go buy, and when you catch it, and you're like, holy shit, I just caught a $500 fish that feels pretty good. Like, if you go catch a 30-pound king, you got a valuable fish. Or a 100-pound halibut is a valuable fish. Then there's stuff that you go catch, which is a lot of ocean fish, that's like really not that expensive and pretty widely available. I don't think about it too much. Would I prefer that squid were worth $100 a pound? Sure.
Hmm.
Why not?
It would probably attract attention, though.
Then it might.
It might be
attention.
The reason why you can walk down there every night and find a spot on the fishing piers because they don't have that much value.
Because even if you get a limit, when you get a limit, but here's the thing: frozen squid. If you get a limit's 10 pounds, so you could feasibly walk down, and if you got the time to put in and you're good at it, you could walk down, and every time you walk off the pier, you're walking off with a fresh version of something that has a commercial value of less than $50. If you get a limit. What's the limit of squirrels worth? Can't sell squirrel. There's no commercially available squirrel, but what would a limit of squirrels really be worth? If you rolled up to a guy and said, hey man, I got 5 squirrels. What do you give me for them?
Well, people haven't assigned a very high value to it. They should. They don't know any better. So you're really not going to get very far.
Unless
you ran into me.
wouldn't want to buy some other guy's squirrels.
Yeah, maybe. But, you know, I know that when I did some bartering back in the day, some trading.
Before you realized it was illegal?
Yeah. With elk meat, I mean, I put a very high value on that. I mean, $100 a pound.
You do know it's illegal to barter elk
meat. Yeah. Don't do it anymore. Now I just give it away.
But I think with this...
Yeah, you give... It's like it's hard to define, right?
Yeah.
Because for instance, I recently said to my brother, who really missed, because he lives in Alaska, he really misses panfish. They don't have panfish. So, because we fish a lot of perch, I said, hey man, when you come down for Christmas, bring a cooler, because I froze you a huge block of perch fillets.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, I'm bringing a cooler anyways, because I'm bringing down a bunch of king salmon for you. Now, I don't imagine someone's going to kick my door down and arrest me. And
no.
There's not like I never said to him, I'll give you X and you'll give me X. It's just that there's a type of sharing that goes on, but I think you can't formalize it.
Yeah, we should look into that.
Yeah, it's just so odd because, I mean, this is stuff I do all the time. But the funny thing is invariably, like, the circle that I trade amongst, we also end up eating at the same dinner table with a lot of those.
You eat it together anyways. Yeah, like, yeah, I'll give them the purge, and then we'll eat the purge together.
Right.
But if there's no money exchange, is it still illegal?
You can't actually, yeah, you can't go. You know what someone just recently sent me? I feel like it's probably a thing put on a sting operation, but someone just recently sent me a Craigslist ad where some guy's like, hey, we only eat wild game. I'm willing to pay $4.50 a pound for deer, elk, if there's any hunters out there that would like to sell their game meat. It could be legit or it could be a sting, but someone sent me a screen grab of the ad. But that's a purchase.
I've been solicited that way.
But it's like you can't engage in bartering, which I imagine the definition has to be some sort of formal arrangement. I got a buddy one time that was coming back from shrimping, and there was a guy, it was a crowded pier. He's coming back from shrimping, and there was a guy that was coming back from Lincoln. And my buddy said, so he doesn't know this guy, my buddy says, hey man, I'll trade you some shrimp for one of those Lincoln fillets. And there happened to be an undercover game warden on the pier. Didn't find him, but says, you most definitely will not.
Oh, I find that hard to believe that's
like a sale. He's like making a sale.
But with no money exchanged, how is it considered
goods and
a sale?
Services.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're like doing a thing. But me saying to my bro, hey, I froze you up a thing of perch, and he's like, oh, sweet, you know. Funny you mention that, because I froze you up some kings. Like, I'm not like, my giving him the perch isn't dependent on him giving me the thing, and we're not a formal relation. It's just like an understanding that you like are generous and share.
Yeah, that seems blurred. So if I came down with a flail lingcod and said, Steve, let's eat this lingcod, and on my way out you said, oh, here's an extra neck roast, take that with you.
There's no problem with that. It's you giving me something, me giving you something.
Yeah.
But it's different than a dude showing up on a pier and saying to a guy he doesn't know,
yeah,
I will make a formal trade with you. Because if the guy says, hey, you know, I'll take some shrimp, but I don't want to give you my lingcod fillet, then I guess he just gave the guy some shrimp.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's like
I think it's a slippery slope because it's like, okay, yeah, so we allowed the lingcod shrimp trade, you know? Well, the next time maybe he doesn't have any lingcod, so he's like, well, I'll just give you $20 or you can come by my oil shop and I'll, you know, change your oil or, you know, and all of a sudden you get to a place where you're basically selling the wildlife.
Now, friends of mine in Alaska who are subsistence, who live in subsistence areas, they're allowed to barter.
Hmm.
Yeah, they can barter. In a subsistence area, you can use fish. You can use wild-caught, subsistence-caught fish to do formal bartering.
Do you know about if you can do it with big game?
I don't know if they're allowed to do it. I don't know if they're allowed to do it with big game.
And that fully extends to like the goods and services realm.
Yeah, you can use it as currency.
Gotcha.
Yep.
Gotcha. Service my boat motor, and I'll give you.
You know, I haven't gone and read. I should clarify that this is coming from someone who is deeply familiar with the system.
Gotcha. Yeah,
and that was his explanation to me. But I don't want to stand here and say that I've like thoroughly read it and explored the whole thing. I'm just kind of conveying like what he explained to me about it.
I want to clarify too that it's knowing that squid has no value. It's not going to.
It has a great value.
Sorry, like that you can just go and buy it, you know, for a cheap price at a store. It's not going to change my enthusiasm when I make it and serve it to other people and share it.
All right, let's do this.
I'll be calamari, very excited.
Calamari menu. I want to find out. That'd be a good little project for you, Yanni, as I move things along. What does it cost to buy calamari in a restaurant? A calamari appetizer.
$8 to $12.
Oh. There you go. And it only takes a calamari appetizer in a restaurant is two or three squid.
Three would be, and again, depending on the size of squid, but three I feel like would be a heaping bowl.
So last night we had 40 appetizers worth of squid. So I can't even begin to do that level of math.
We were ripping beaks.
What do you think the cost is?
I'm about ready to, just as a warning, like I give my kids 5 minute warnings when it's time to like leave the playground. I'm about ready to move on.
Go ahead.
5 minute warning. I'm just about ready to move on.
That's roughly $500 worth of calamari plates.
All right. So there you go. Cal, go ahead.
Andrew, what would you say like your standard like breaded fried calamari appetizer would cost to produce from the restaurant side, or like your, you know, simmered sauteed with some peppers calamari appetizer?
Well, really, yeah. I mean, it's really low cost because you think about just the appetizer where you're getting the breaded fried and a little bit of sauce on the side. I mean, there's nothing to it but the squid, a couple cents worth of flour or cornmeal or whatever crust they're going to put on it, and, you know, a tablespoon of mayonnaise, and that's, you're talking, you know.
It's good markup.
Yeah, real good markup.
Can we plug your catering place?
Sure. Well, you could plug anything you want.
Island Time.
On Island Time Catering.
On Island Time. Which does a disservice because you're the most punctual, fast, efficient person I know.
It is a little.
But it's spelled tricky.
T-H-Y-M-E.
Yeah.
A delicious pun.
A delicious pun. So any listeners out there, and what's your range? What's your zone?
You know, mostly San Juan Island, but I also do have a DBA as my own Chef Andy, which I do a lot of more small,
mobile.
Detailed, mobile stuff. Yeah. Obviously, I've done some traveling with you and done some other events in and around, so.
We'll come back around and re-plug you later.
Yeah.
All right, what else? Oh, another thing I wanted to get to before the main thing we want to get to. We're kind of already on subject. We're actually on subject.
Definitely.
But go into... Oh, talk about something for a minute, Yanni.
Oh, boy. Oh, how about the... can I talk about the tour demand tool?
That's what I'm trying to talk
about.
Oh,
that's what you're trying to talk about.
Yeah, hit it. We interrupt this for an announcement from Yanni.
We are going to do a... Do we know how many stops? Roughly? 10, maybe?
Yeah, man, around not somewhere eight to ten range.
8 to 10 live podcast events in the next year. Is that safe to say?
Yeah.
All across the United States, but we don't know where to go. Steve and I had a list going of places we thought we should go, and then we thought, well, it'd probably be better to ask people
to impose some rationale into it.
Mm-hmm.
On it. Instead of just being like, yeah, it seems like a place where a lot of dudes live.
Yeah, and because we'd fight about it, I just kept saying, we got to go to Pennsylvania. They got millions of hunters. Steve's like, nah, nobody's going to come to Pennsylvania. So now if you're in Pennsylvania and you're like, bullshit, we could fill a theater full of people, you can go to, Steve, you got it up?
No, I'm having connectivity issues.
Mm. We're going to have it's called a tour demand tool.
Yes.
And we're going to embed it across all of our social channels, platforms. You'll be able to find it there. And basically go on there and you're just going to have to type in like, I don't even know if it requires your name, but basically your zip code.
Zip code and email.
Zip code and email. And
then we'll open up a dialogue with you.
Yeah.
And you just request your zip code.
And you want to get all your buddies to do it, too, if they live in and around your area. Because whoever gets basically the most votes, that's where we're going to end up.
Yeah, this is not like screwing around. This is like how we're actually figuring out where to go.
Yeah.
And it looks cool, too. It's a really easy little thing.
Yeah. By saying you want us there, you're basically saying, yeah, I'd buy a ticket to go to the event.
What size theaters are you guys looking at?
A few hundred folks.
Mm-hmm.
We did one in Bozeman. How many seats were in Bozeman?
440, I believe.
Yeah. And that sold out a couple weeks before it happened.
Mm-hmm.
So you folks got to get on this if you're going to do it. When it happens, you got to strike fast. Or as Yanni says, you got to be on the dance. What was the thing you were talking about yesterday? Being on the...
Opportunity dances with those on the dance floor.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, now to get back on subject. You know what my brother Matt... And Pooter, you've been hanging out with Matt for 20 years. Yeah. You know what my brother Matt's favorite... recipe is right now, his favorite wild game recipe. I need to like set the stage a little bit about Matt. No, I won't. I'll just let this speak for itself. Matt, when he butchers a deer, do you know about this? His new thing he likes to eat?
No.
Okay. When Matt butchers a deer, he saves all the scrap. So like the tallow, mm-hmm. tendon, silver skin, and kind of throws a rough mince on it and saves it in a little, like when you open his cupboards, he say like every butter tub or cream cheese container that guy has ever generated.
Coffee.
Anything he has. He's just like, he's got a large area of his kitchen that's dedicated to just him where he throws any sort of little tub.
I think he actually, he probably grocery shops based on those
the tub size.
Yeah. He's like, yeah, I'm kind of out of this.
I can use a tub like
I don't
that.
Need any butter this week. Well, I'll get some margarine because it comes in that.
Because that's the kind of tub I like.
When I was over there, we came back from that turkey hunt and somebody had snuck by and put three garbage bags full of Folgers containers in his kitchen.
He loves containers and tubs. So one of the things he does with his containers and tubs is he freezes scrap, deer scrap, because his dog likes to eat it. So when he goes to feed his dog, he'll take one of these little tubs, frozen, just with scrap in it, and just add a little water to it and put it in his microwave for a bunch of minutes.
Oh, but did you say what originally those tubs were for?
Butter and coffee and cream cheese.
No. Why he was making them.
Yeah, for his dog.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. I wasn't paying attention.
Oh, something else. So, because then he'll microwave it, like, to oblivion or until it turns into, like, it's something that would have an industrial application if you needed something like an organic type of rubber.
Yeah.
Right? And he gives it to his dog, Shifty, on its food. Well, I don't know how it happened, but he one day just must have been hungry or whatever, and now that's what he likes to have, and that's how he likes to fix it.
Ooh.
So his deer, he's now like, the thing he likes to eat is the tallow, tendon, and silver skin and blood clots microwaved in little tubs that he then likes
he
to
He must
just,
salt it, at least.
I think he does put salt on it. Yeah, and that's his hot tip.
Yeah, I think the microwaving in the tub is really what pulls that dish together.
That's his hot tip.
Infuse a little plastic. Ooh, flavor.
Yeah. My latest hot tip. There's my cooking hot tip. And this is hard to replicate. But I recently had a mule deer buck tenderloin that I seared in a pan and then... So just brown it on all sides, rubbed it with salt and pepper, seared it in a pan. So I browned it on all sides and stuck it in a 400 degree oven for not long enough. So that when I pulled it out, like I don't have any reason to think this, but I feed my kids a lot of like really extremely rare meat,
mm-hmm.
which I used to worry that something bad would happen to them. But if they've been alive long enough now, or if something bad was going to happen to them, would have happened to them by now. But anyways, I still sometimes will cut into a piece of meat and I'll be like, my God, that is raw. You know?
Can I interrupt?
But then they eat it and they're fine. Yeah, go ahead.
I just want to ask, like from a professional chef's perspective, is there anything, like at what point can something like that get dangerous? Like raw meat? Because I think that's probably in a lot of people's minds.
Well, I think
minds.
You guys have the most experience with that as far as the bear. I mean, you know.
Yeah, deer meat. No, my worry.
Let's just go, yeah, with venison.
No, large game animal, you could eat it raw. You know what I mean?
But yeah. That's my concern is it parasites.
Yeah.
My concern is just that it's like, could be potentially be hard for their system.
Right.
A two-year-old?
Yeah. But you got to work and experiment, you know?
But it doesn't phase them. Because I think because they've just been eating the whole time. I remember my brother had this girlfriend who was vegetarian for a long time. And then one day we shot a deer and she ate a whole bunch of rare deer meat and was puking her brains out because it's just like
shocked her system.
So that's my concern more than other things.
Yeah.
But anyways, then I wrapped this thing up, what was left of it, wrapped it up in saran wrap and left it in my fridge for like a week. Then there's a sandwich shop called Mean Sandwich. And they have a habanero sauce. And somehow, I don't really know how, I haven't like checked with everyone in my family yet to understand how this happened. But one of their containers of habanero sauce ended up in my fridge. It's like a thinking man's Frank's Red Hot. Buttery.
Mm-hmm.
So I took my raw deer meat, my mostly raw week-old deer meat back out cut it in slices, melted a bunch of butter in a pan, recooked it all over again in that butter, dredged it in that habanero sauce that I found, and that was the best thing I've ever eaten in my entire life. Hard to replicate. It's a lot of steps.
Yeah.
And it involves you going to mean sandwich.
And time. I mean, if you're going
to. And it allows you to let it
age.
To have a thing kind of cooked in your fridge under plastic wrap for 7 days. The best thing I ever ate.
Wow.
That's my hot tip. You got a hot tip from Matt?
Really like
which
spicy.
Is microwave. No, I'm not. Like I said, it's a thinking man's habanero sauce, though. Spicy. Too spicy for my kids. My two-year-old insisted that I give him some, and he declared it spicy. That's my hot tip. Poot, what's your
like
hot? What's your hot tip?
Hot tip.
Poot's tips. Well, I should clarify that Andy, while it's not his name, he has never once introduced himself as such as widely known as Poot. So if I say Pooter, that's who I'm talking about, is Andrew.
I like that style, though, when you take that that backstrap or tenderloin like that and sear it on the outside and have that rare bit in the middle, but then pan sear that later because...
Is that a thing? I thought I invented that the other night.
No, but it just, it reminds me of like, of taking like a, you know, like a roast beef, like a raw, or no, medium rare roast beef, but then turning that into like a steak sandwich, you know what I mean?
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Hit that
yeah.
hot in a pan with the onions and peppers, and the flavor that then comes out of that, I think is, I love that. Yeah. I'm a sandwich guy, though.
You like making sandwiches?
Love sandwiches.
You familiar with mean sandwiches?
Nope. Where's that at?
Over in Ballard.
No. I'll check it out.
Yeah. Good sauce.
Hmm.
Give me another hot tip, Poot. That one didn't count.
Hot tip. Well, we were kind of talking about earlier, just in the way of is bringing it back a little bit, but the way that things are handled and processed along the way, you know what I mean? I over the years of hanging out with you guys and then seeing the way that things have evolved, especially up at the shack. You think about how kind of crude it was at the beginning. Things were just kind of getting right off the flay table, wrapped in a saran wrap and whacked in the freezer. And to see that evolution of...
The introduction of more expensive stuff.
Correct. And I think just a general care, you know. Like your brother Danny's just meticulous on his fillets, you know. And yeah. You can always tell the difference. But I think that translates down the line so well from the way that it's handled... A, when it comes like right out of the water or obviously an animal that you put down on the ground. And every step that's taken, if there's care that goes into every little step, I think the end result is leaps and bounds above
it adds up.
Everything.
Yeah, because like a wrong move dealing with fish, like a couple wrong moves can really put you in a bad spot.
Yeah, yeah. And when you pull that out of the freezer and it you have a piece of meat that's just absolutely pristine, it's just like, I don't know, to me it's like Christmas, you know, to be able to pull that out and not be like, ooh, well, we got to cut this away. We got to, you know, it elevates everything along the way, I think.
We were down fishing blue catfish in Kentucky. We went to this guy's house and until we started hanging out, we went down and spent a bunch of time in Kentucky. Jugging, limb lining. What else? Trot lining.
Yeah, those three.
Jugging, limb lining, and trot lining for channels, flats, and blues.
Mm. Turtles.
And turtles. And I'd always liked to fish catfish, but I never understood. And I knew that there was catfish that you put in your mouth, and it was like, oh my God, is that bad? And there was catfish you put in your mouth, it's like, wow, that's great. I never realized that the difference between those two things is fat.
Mm-hmm.
The catfish fat tastes horrible. And we went down with a guy who catches, I want to say probably thousands of pounds of catfish a year.
Oh, yeah.
Because we had
easy.
Because we had in the hundreds, maybe. We had 20-some catfish that day. Not hundreds. We had a lot
maybe
of catfish.
Maybe not 100 pounds of fillets.
No. But live weight. You know, I think we had in the 70s for live weight. Bunch of guys fishing. Either way, the guy cleans a lot of catfish. And to watch this guy, he just fishes blue catfish with jugs. But to watch this guy go through his cleaning process and how meticulous and fastidious and like, this is the way you do it. You don't do it that way. And his setup and how carefully he defats those fillets. And then he'd take all that pieced up meat and put it in a wheelbarrow with a hose in it and would just stare at it and stare at it and stare at it, watching for any little wisps of oil that would be floating on the surface. And what he would go through to get it where he's like, now that's ready to eat. And that's the difference between good catfish and bad catfish. Yeah. Well, a guy like that.
I think you should follow that up with that we sort of had a, you know, an impromptu, you know, like a check on that the other day when we were cooking catfish.
Oh, yeah.
It's that little strip of dark on the belly, right? That's
it's that, and there's that orange fat. Yeah, yeah, yeah. There's the bloodline, which they're real careful about getting rid of, and then there's fat. And the other day, we had some catfish, a huge catfish. We're just like trying to test the catfish recipe and had a big piece of catfish, and I didn't defat it. I kind of like half-assed defatted it, and ugh, that mud.
And it was store-bought.
Yeah.
And I think that kind of tripped us up because we just figured, ah, store-bought, it's been well taken care of, you know, not so much.
We kind of took that same approach when we were fishing those, shoveling those sturgeon up, yeah, up at the Yellowstone, and they kind of have that same, and we're kind of watching videos, and they said it's really important that you make sure you clean it all the way down to the white meat. And so we were kind of, you know, taking our time removing, and we did a little tester, and it, you could taste the difference.
Oh, yeah. And I found it, too, even like on, there's certain species. Salmon, it's weird, because salmon, why are king salmon so popular?
Yeah.
Fat.
Because of the fat.
Because the fat's so great on them.
Yeah.
You know, well, I mean, there's a lot of, like, I why is domestic pork fat real tasty, but deer fat is not? Mm. So king salmon, people like them because they're fatty. When we've butchered sharks, like lemon sharks, you got to get all that fat off. Hmm. Or else it tastes nasty. So real careful is what you're saying.
Yeah. And then your brother Matt took all those little pieces, put them in a tub, put them in a microwave.
Microwave those in a cream cheese tub for 5 minutes and turns them back into gold. Yanni, what's your hot tip?
Ooh. I wasn't ready for this.
Really?
Hot tip. Cal, you got one? Come back to me.
I got one I real consistently get complimented on anything involving the morel mushroom is I dry all my mushrooms. And then you have to reconstitute them to cook with them. And I guess you don't have to, but I do. And so they sit in a bowl of water for, you know, 24 hours in the fridge. And then I'll pull those mushrooms out, snip them in half with kitchen shears, give them a rinse again in the same water, let that calm down, pull those mushrooms out and kind of give them a light little squeeze to drain that water back in there. And then I'll strain the water, the liquid that I use to reconstitute the mushrooms.
Yep.
And then I just use that as mushroom stock for whatever sauce or the roast that I'm cooking with the mushrooms. And it makes a difference.
Are you familiar though with the school of thought that you should never ever wash?
Yes.
A wild mushroom. But those people don't deal with mushrooms out of burns.
Well, morels just with the gills on the outside. They are, and they're hollow on the inside, so they're like natural bug homes, worm homes.
Yeah, and I'd always read that about how you shouldn't rinse them. And you see it in all kinds of places, like use a gentle brush. That might be true if you're, depending on where. If you're like picking morels in some kind of like real grassy river bottom area where it's the nice mat of grass, and he's like living there in a dust-free environment.
And you found him that day, and there was like a nice dew on the grass or something. Yeah.
I've spent more time eating morels that I didn't wash because you're not supposed to wash them and having a miserable time wondering about like what's going to happen to my teeth.
Yeah.
From the grit that I'm eating.
Because even if you, especially when I'm cooking for other folks, I'm real gentle with them because I want them to be pretty. it's impossible to clean those things.
Yeah.
Like, you will never get every stitch of dirt.
I soak them. I think they're hardy enough. You know, they're not like
morels.
Yeah,
to get the grit.
Not like a shaggy man that's just going to dissolve. It's hardy enough to hold up to. Well, I usually soak them for a while fresh.
Just to get them clean.
Just to rinse them. Yeah.
My bro one time was picking them. He was out trying to pick them for sale. He had a commercial permit in a big burn. You know, they'll open up like commercial harvesting. Just to clarify. So, just for listeners, mushrooms have like a mycorrhizal. Is that, am I saying the word right? Mycorrhiza. There's an underground, the mycelium or something like that.
Mycelium.
A mushroom has an underground structure. So when you see a mushroom pop up, this isn't a good, perfect analogy, but just think about it like this. When a mushroom pops up, you're seeing the apple of an apple tree. But in the mushroom's case, it's not, you know, it's not the same thing as a plant, but it's fungi. But what you're seeing is the macrofructation, the fruiting body of a very large underground network of mycelia.
I think it's, yeah, mycelium.
Mycelium, yeah.
A big structure. This, like, imagine as this tree-like underground structure that puts off a fruit. When we talk about morels after forest fires, there's something that happens that's not well understood. That the underground structure of the morel is there. It's like omnipresent. It's just down there. And something about the action of the fire.
It might be that it stresses that whole system out, and it's like, holy hell, we got to get out of here.
Yeah, and and they will all of a sudden crank out. You could have scorched earth.
Yes, moon dust.
And the following, well, it could happen different times. Generally, if it burns one summer, so it burns in August, the following April, May, June, depending on elevation, latitude, and other factors, all of a sudden, in the right place, it's just a bonanza where, whap, it is carpeted in morels.
That is the difference between mushroom hunting and mushroom harvesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and guys that commercially harvest morels will often, that's where commercially harvested morels are coming out of, oftentimes, is out of big burns. Where you can go and pick like 100 pounds of morels. Now, my bro one time picked a bunch, fixing to sell, and he'd picked them after a rain. And his entire pick was rejected for how gritty. Too much ash.
Wow.
Can't get them clean.
Hmm.
So he then had his tub supply got maxed because he then had like everything possible. He was like drying morels nonstop, and then we ate gritty mushrooms for.
And I've done like a pretty damned abusive cleaning process on these before, and I think the right way to do it lies somewhere in the middle. Like, it's amazing how much that mushroom gets beaten up, and when you're finally draining your wash tub, bucket, tub, whatever, how much mushroom is on the bottom there and residue down there with all the ash and.
And every third morel you open up has a roly-poly in it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, they're buggy, they're dirty, but...
Man, they're delicious.
Yeah.
Buggy. Hey, Yanni, will you type up... I just want to get people square. Type up mycelium and mycorrhiza. Mycelium being M-Y-C-E-L-I-U-M. Mycorrhiza being M-Y-C-H... You'll figure it out.
No, I've been told that they're... is hardly a surface out there that doesn't have a morel spore on it.
I've seen them come up in some crazy places.
Yeah. Did you see those studies they've done where they've gone in, like they go into a school where you have like a building with tons of small rooms and multi floors on it, and they'll go in with a mushroom and walk down the hall and then wait some period of time and then go in and test the air and the spores.
Yeah.
No.
The spore. Yeah, like a mushroom spore. There's a thing, like a lot of mushroom hunters be like, oh, you can only carry your mushrooms in a basket, not a bag, because you need to make sure the spores are getting out and being distributed.
Yeah. That.
But people say the spores are omnipresent.
Yeah, they're everywhere. And it's multiple generations that are, the way I've been told now is, you know, they are the mushroom hunters they are where they are type deal. They're just waiting for that combination of heat but not too much heat, moisture but not too much moisture, disturbance but not too much disturbance to create that little micro climate that they like.
Yeah, when you're hunting, you're going to your spots. Like I've been hunting.
They just put off all the time.
That I know, over 20 years, I know every year there'll be a mushroom in that same spot.
Yeah, and you just got to be there on the right day.
And it is, yeah. You watch the weather, you wait for that perfect soil condition, and then you go out there and boom, there they are.
And I've had a couple times where I moved away from an area and then very ceremoniously passed along my morel spots.
Yeah. I'm not sure if I'd do that. I mean, those are, there's certain things that I just cannot part with. I'm like,
want it to be that. I'd rather no one picked.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly
I'd rather they rotted into the ground.
It is so hard to find them sometimes. But one cool experiment for folks that are into picking mushrooms is if, you get your mushrooms home, you lay them out on a big screen, and you start that drying process, they will, and it must be somewhat forcibly discharge those spores on the screen. And so, if you have like a dark window screen, you remove that mushroom and then you look and it leaves a really beautiful
spore print.
Design of spores on there. And I always thought somebody much more artsy than me could probably make something cool.
Well, that's a diagnostic tool for IDing mushrooms.
It is, yeah.
Is you take a spore print because you look at a mushroom, you're like, that sumbitch, a mushroom is brown. But you'll be reading like, you're trying to go like, so is it the good one that looks like that or the poison one that looks like that? And it'll say, the good one that looks like that will throw a purple spore print. The poison one that looks like that will throw a yellow spore print. And you lay that thing out on a white piece of paper and get a spore print. You look at it like, I don't know how, it's brown, but that's got a yellow, there's a yellow mark on that paper. I've only been poisoned by mushrooms one time.
Was it a real deal or was it just
gastrointestinal upset?
Okay.
So like wild mushrooms have two... A mycologist, which is a mycologist is a mushroom biologist. A mycologist might hear this and be like, that's not right. But this is, I can guarantee you that this is kind of right. There's mushroom toxins that are neurotoxins, okay, that mess with your head, like eating shrooms, right? That'd be like a neurotoxin. And then there's mushroom toxins that just like screw you up your digestive tract, right? So that they mess your brain up or they mess your gut up. I got messed up by the gut kind, and it was eating queen bleats while caribou hunting. And I'd eaten a million queen bleats in the lower 48. Not a million, but quite a handful. And then we were eating them up there. And then I later learned from a mycologist who was saying, it's a thing that a lot of people who can eat queen bleats wind up being intolerant of the queen bleats on the Arctic slope.
Whoa.
Some difference about them. There's a mushroom that is highly toxic unless a caribou or reindeer eats it. Then you can drink that reindeer's piss and trip.
That's taking it to the extreme.
That's a lot of work.
Yeah, it's one of the, it's like the fly agaric or one of the related to that. It's like when you're watching a cartoon and there's a mushroom, it's a red mushroom with white spots on it that's like present in all cartoons. It's like, the classic poison mushroom, which grow right near my house. There's some of those. Most falls, there's some of those about 150 yards from here. A white mushroom, a red mushroom with white spots out, like in the Smurfs stuff, that's the mushroom. Yeah, but if a reindeer eats it and you drink his piss, you'll trip. Not that I've done it, but it's a thing that Siberian herders do. It's... Tripping,
wild group
tripping
of guys.
Tripping in the boreal forest. What'd you find out, Yanni? Have you done your research?
Yeah. You just want the definition of the two?
Yeah, because
mycelium is the vegetative part of a fungus or fungus-like bacterial colony.
Okay.
Consisting of a mass of branching thread-like hyphae.
That's who's living under the ground.
Yeah.
Mycorrhizal, is that a term for the relationship?
Yes. Symbiotic association between a fungus and the roots of a vascular host plant.
Yeah, because like morels, They have. That's right. Now it's come back to me. Morels have a mycorrhizal relationship with, say, tulip poplars in Virginia, elm trees near where I used to live, cottonwoods, aspens.
Must be ponderosa pines.
Apple,
I found some underneath some ponderosa.
Apple orchards in some places. And you might have none of these things growing in your yard and haul in some wood chips. And then all of a sudden realize you had some morels pop out of your wood chips.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen that happen.
Yeah.
When I was a tree surgeon.
Interesting. Because, yeah, people do that now, right? Like they bring in half-rotten logs in special locations.
Doug Dern does that.
Yeah.
Now,
not for morels, but he does it.
A quality difference. And this is something we've tested out thoroughly between what we refer to as natural morels, which are non-fire-producing morels.
Okay. Yeah.
And your fire morels. Now, your fire morels typically overabundance. Bonanza abundance the year after the fire, and then they decline rapidly, sometimes from what I've seen, fall off the face of the earth. They're just not
The next year.
The next year.
Yeah.
Now, you have your annual spots where, if the conditions are right, they'll produce every single year.
The big, giant yellows. Morchella esculenta.
Even if they're small or blonde or black, the wall of the mushroom seems to just be meatier.
Gotcha.
And, man, those things, there's a...
That's something I've noticed but never thought about. You're right. I never, like, correlated it to location, but some morels just have a wall on them.
I got one about the size of, perfect size of a good high-walled saute pan. And,
One mushroom.
Wow. And, did...
How big is a saute pan?
This was, probably a 14...
Holy shit.
Yeah. You ever see the back of Mushrooms Demystified? The morels the dude's holding on the back of that book?
Yeah.
No.
Head-sized morels, man.
Oh. So, but I smoked this thing with the smoked octopus, elk Italian sausage, spicy, and like a nice, you know, mirepoix, probably carrots and some celery and stuff, and baked that baby for a little while and topped her off some mushroom sauce or some tomato sauce, and tough to beat, man. But cutting through that thing, the point here,
it's like a steak.
It is a steak.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're like, woo! You know, it fights back against the knife. It's great.
Now, Cal, talk us through your tongue preparation.
Are you guys going to cover this in the new cookbook?
Yeah, we talk about tongues in there.
Good. Good.
But I know you're like a big tongue man.
Every day.
Hey, is that a recipe that you share?
Yeah, it is.
Oh,
it is.
Maybe you could share with me, and then I can share it with the rest of the world.
Yeah.
Why can't he just tell us right now how he likes to cook game tongues?
Well, yeah, he can do that as well, but it's hard to then replicate that.
People are dying to know. I get questions every single day. Hey, got a tongue. You guys talked me into taking a tongue. You got,
now what do I do with this damn thing?
Yeah, exactly. So the quick version is I prefer a pressure cooker. I'll pile a bunch of tongues in there, let it roll on high for like 20 minutes.
Can you back up?
Yeah.
At what point do you think a tongue is worth messing with?
I take them all.
Even out of like a white-tailed
little
goat.
Tiny white-tails, that mountain goat this year.
All right.
Take them all.
Any old tongue.
Yeah. I know I am not as picky as some folks.
And you speed cut it, where you open up the bottom of the jaw.
Yep.
Pull it out.
Yeah, it's almost out of like Scarface, right?
Yeah, it almost wants to come out.
Yeah, so you cut along the inside line of the jaw, and then you can kind of reach up there and hook it, and then you're cutting at the back of the trachea and. And the rest is pretty explanatory.
It's disturbing how fast you can get a tongue out.
It is.
You like to think that your tongue's in there better than it is.
Yes. Now, if your critter has frozen, like if you chucked her in the back of the truck and it froze overnight, then you have to be more careful because there's a good chance you're going to cut through a portion of your tongue, and then you got to kind of cook it right away because the nice thing is they're all self-contained. So the peeling part is...
You wash it.
You wash it. Pressure... I like the pressure cooker, but you can just boil it also.
Just flat ass, like, that's it. You're not brining it ahead of time. Just
not for the way I like to cook it.
No, please. That's what I'm trying to find out.
And then I'll take it just like a pepper and throw it in the freezer, like paper bag, throw it in the freezer, and then you start working on your sauce, which chopped up a bunch of...
Back up.
Just like a pepper.
I got that part. You're not, for my likings, you're not spending enough time on what it is you're doing by pressure cooking and boiling it.
Okay.
And or boiling it.
So basically, your tongue has... and that's true. Your tongue, everybody's tongue, has this rind on the outside, a skin.
Yeah.
The meat on the inside is nice and fatty, which is probably why I like it so much. And by boiling it, you are getting that skin to kind of release, I would think. And then...
To get it where it slips off.
Yeah. And then if you chuck that thing in the freezer... for reasons unknown to me, it separates really easy, like finger peel with zero meat loss.
Yeah.
Cause you don't want that.
But the tip is difficult.
The tip is difficult and it can be triaged. And that's where like your small white tail tongues, the chucking it in the freezer for 20 minutes is kind of critical because you get too much meat loss if it sticks to that.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you have to like use a knife to shave it.
That's what I've found. So like if I'll simmer it for 3 to 4 hours, depending on how big the tongue is. And I just keep checking by jabbing a fork into the base.
Yeah.
And then I throw mine in an ice water bath.
Yeah. Same result?
You know, it varies so much.
It does.
Like I was with a buddy of mine, a chef. You remember that? Have you met Matt Weingarten, mm-hmm. that chef? I was watching him do 9 veal tongues one time, and the outer skin on a veal tongue is not well adhered to the tongue like it is on a game animal, because he just like simmer them for 2 hours, throw them in an ice water bath, and it was like taking someone's shoe off.
Yeah.
The skin was just like, whoop, gone. Ah. I'm like, dude, that ain't anything like what I've experienced, because I'll boil them for 3 to 4 hours, and then I'll be able to get the base of the tongue slipped off, but then I'm in there with a paring knife working away on the tip.
Yeah.
Because just you're getting that outer skin layer off.
And maybe in subconsciously, that's why I would kind of wait till Thanksgiving or Christmas when I've... Because if I help pack somebody's critter out of the woods for them, you know, I'd typically have an abundance of meat. But everybody's like, hey, do you want a quarter off this thing? I'm like, yeah, just give me the tongue.
Yeah. Right? It's gotten where people fight over the tongues.
I know.
I was talking to Remy Warren and got an elk. He got an elk. And I was like, you know, and he was like, go ahead and grab what you want off the elk. And I like grabbed myself up and I grabbed the tongue. He's like, oh, no, not that. I don't care. He's like, I don't care about the tenderloins and back straps. Don't take the tongue.
Man, it's the real deal. So then while this meat, your tongues are in the freezer, I work on the sauce, which... My buddy Jim Ciardelli, this is mom's Creole sauce is what he calls it. But it's chopped green olives, pimentos, garlic, red wine, black pepper, and crushed canned tomatoes. So, should I just get tomatoes? No, get canned tomatoes.
Yeah, that school of thought bugs me. When people are like down on you for using... It's just different.
Yeah.
It's just different. It's helpful sometimes.
Yeah, but I don't know if it's super helpful, but is it like a coming out of the depression thing? I don't know. Like, no, just use canned tomatoes.
Pooter, are you prejudiced against canned tomatoes?
No, I use them all the time.
You do?
Yeah. I mean, there's an application for them. I mean,
yeah,
they're processed to the point where you want to put them into a sauce, you know?
Yeah. So get this sauce kind of simmering, you know, with enough liquid and I also use my reconstituted morels and the juice accompanying that, and then I'll pull the tongues out, I'll peel the tongues, chop the tongues into, you know, about, you know, your thumbnail size pieces, maybe a little bit bigger, and just let that simmer. And then I'll fry polenta. I'll just get the, you know, the tubes of polenta that you see at the store.
Yep.
Cut them into rounds and give them a nice little fry. And then, and crock pot's perfect for this too. But, you know, take, you know, sauce and a couple of chunks and make sure there's morel in there and stack it up all nice on that polenta and a little bit of parsley on top. And it's fantastic. Love it.
That's the tone. Sounds good.
I mean, it's my, it is a meal I look forward to every year. And it's simple. I mean, it's not kitchen magic, right?
What I've been doing, like, I tend to smoke them.
There's a lot of quizzical, kind of real questioning, raised eyebrows for our listeners here. They're really staring me down.
No, not at all. I like this. I just didn't know that's what you're doing with the tongues. I like it.
Okay.
Yeah, we've been hearing about it for years, about your fancy tongue dish, but I don't know if you'd ever explain it to us.
Yeah, I'd put it more on like the peasant side of things, right? Peasant dish, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's like traditionally. But, you know, in the old days, they were so valuable that it would warrant people to go out and hunt buffalo just for the tongues. You could get a couple bucks for the tongue.
And
you could get a dollar or two for the tongue, which is huge money back then.
They were pickling them, right?
They'd pickle them and pack them in barrels of salt and ship them east just packed in salt packed.
And then was it like a bar food or?
Yeah, pickled tongue and smoked tongue.
Okay.
Yeah. And they would pack them in salt barrels. One time there was a case where in the historical account, there's a case where a group of Sioux hunters near the junction of the Yellowstone flows into the Missouri, which I think was Fort Union sits there, where the Yellowstone River hits the Missouri in North Dakota. I think that's Fort Union. And a group of Sioux hunters killed 5,000 buffalo near the fort and just sold the tongues out of them because it was valuable.
Oh.
Yeah. There's a lot of cases like that.
I do have to say, like, my Eastern Montana family, I made this tongue as an appetizer for the whole clan. Last Christmas, and the kind of the older generation was pretty skeptical because every single person there was like ranch family. Once they made it sound like once a week, it was just kind of on the rotation. There would be a beef tongue that had been brined into pastrami, and it was beef tongue sandwiches once a week, and they were not super jacked to be eating tongue. But
I basically make a pastrami with the tongues.
And I mean, that's got to be good, right?
I love it. Yeah. But that's what I stole from Matt Weingart.
And I think what's surprising about it is just the texture. When it's handled right, how tender it actually is. Oh, yeah. It just falls apart.
You know? Yeah.
And when you cut it, it's got like a weird mosaic of like white and red.
Mm-hmm.
Cool pattern.
Yeah, a couple years back when you did, we did Thanksgiving at your place and we had maybe three or four tongues that I think you had brined and smoked.
Yep.
And they were just phenomenal. Really good.
I brine them while I like cure them.
Yeah.
With a dry brine, and I vac seal them in a bag with the dry brine.
Do you cure them with the sheath on?
Yep. Take the whole damn tongue, scrub it with a scrub brush, have a cure, salt, sugar, and seasonings, and vac seal it in with the dry cure, and throw it in my fridge for a week or two.
Mm-hmm.
And just flip it now and then in the vac sealed bag because the liquid settles and you flip it and the liquid settles. Then I smoke it for a long time. Then I braise it to peel the skin.
Hmm.
And then that liquid that you braise it in winds up being amazing.
Yeah.
It's like a smoked stock.
Yeah.
Then I slip the tin.
There's a lot of fat in there.
Oh, yeah. A lot of fat in there.
Yeah. That moose tongue that we got up in BC. I stole your moose tongue from that one on the river trip. That I threw in the pressure cooker, let cool completely, like cold, peeled it, sliced it super thin, olive oil, salt, pepper. And a moose tongue's a big tongue. That thing disappeared. About six people took that thing down.
Yeah, it's 3 pound tongue.
Yeah, and it was, I mean, it just phenomenal. But it was just cold, good olive oil, salt, pepper. It was fantastic.
All right, I'm going to walk folks through on how to do deer ribs. Which is like, it's very important because people don't understand this. I was one time down in South Carolina, and we took a deer to a deer processor. Or no, we didn't. We just went, so we dropped by a deer processor in South Carolina. And this guy, as he's like admitting deer into his processing plant, skins them and takes a Sawzall and cuts the rib rack right off and throws it out with the feet. Like, not even going to look at it. A processor.
I don't know if there's...
You call me a liar?
No. No. I'm adding to your story. I just think that I don't know if there's a processor in our country that deals with venison ribs.
Really?
And I don't even think that I'm saying that with just deboning them for the grind pile. I mean, I live near one and I see the mountain of carcasses. Those, they're all ribs intact.
Really?
And it's mostly elk, you know.
Elk ribs. So anyways, okay, here's what you should do with your deer ribs. If you don't do this, you're stupid. Take, skin the deer. You got the deer to skin it. And eventually you got where you got, there's the deer laying there and he's got his ribs on him. And because you already gutted him, you already split the sternum. So go down along the spine with a saw and cut the ribs free along the spine so that you wind up with a Fred Flintstone rib rack. We'll put up a picture with the show notes. We'll put up a picture of pictures of how to do this, of what I'm talking about. Take that rib rack and then saw, if you're talking about a general standard issue whitetail deer, saw that rib rack into three long strips where you're cutting cross bone. Is this making sense?
Yep.
And you're going to wind up with three strips of what looks like pork ribs from a restaurant.
Yeah. And what you did the other day that was slick that I hadn't seen is you rolled the ribs into...
Before sawing them.
Yeah.
Yeah. You could take that whole rib rack and you have the... it might not make sense listening to me, but once you're doing it, you'll understand what I'm talking about. Depending on how you cut this whole thing. You can take the rib rack and just roll it up. Like a river rafting table. What do they call those tables? Roll top tables?
Roll a table. Roll yeah. Time Industries.
Roll it up like a river rafting table.
The good folks that brought you roll a cot.
Saw it. So you're cutting cross bone. You're going to wind up with three long strips, 10, 11 ribs, in pieces that are about 6 inches long. 5, 6 inches long, depending on the size of the deer. Then you cut those down into pieces that have two or three ribs per piece. So you have two or three ribs that are 6 inches long, connected by all the meat that was over and under them. Let me back up. If it's a particularly fatty deer, take a boning knife and cut away as much of the tallow as you can. Am I missing anything else, Yanni?
No.
No. Do all that. Cut them what?
Well, unless you want to mention, I guess, what I was thinking about is when you're cutting it off the carcass, you sort of end up with having the, like, where there's like almost like a 90-degree turn of bone at the top end going to the spine.
Yeah.
It doesn't really have a lot of meat on
but
it.
There's a seam in there.
There's a seam, and that's really where you should be cut. So it's not quite right against the spine.
If you're real crafty and good with a knife, you can cut it. There's a joint. There's like a joint in the rib. It doesn't look like it, but it's there. And you can actually cut it with a knife if you know what you're doing. Mm-hmm. But... just the Sawzall is fine too.
Yeah. And then on the bottom edge, you're sort of dealing with where it joins into the
sternum. And there's a joint there. If you know what you're doing, you can cut that with a knife. But I'm trying not to get people intimidated.
Hmm. Well, I'm just saying, yeah. You might run into this, so you can just saw it off too.
Yeah. Like right now, like I'm playing rhythm guitar and Yanni is soloing off of the rhythm, right? I'm like telling you the basic outline and Yanni's adding texture. So keep doing that.
All right.
But you're cool up so far.
I'm great.
Now, take these things, and if you have a pressure cooker, so now you got all these blocks of ribs that look like what you'd get if you order ribs in a restaurant. If you have a pressure cooker, take these things and put them in your pressure cooker and put an inch or two of water in your pressure cooker with them and pressure cook them at 10 pounds of pressure for 20 minutes.
Now, do you put any rub on that beforehand?
Not yet.
Not yet.
You can, But I don't think it's necessary.
Okay.
I don't think it's necessary at this point. Straight up water out of the faucet.
And if you don't have a pressure cooker,
put them in a slow cooker. Crock pot or slow cooker. If you don't have one of those, put it in a Dutch oven or some kind of oven-safe receptacle. Cover them up in water and put them in your oven or put them in your slow cooker and cook them for 3 hours until they're fork tender. You want to cook them until this happens. Until you could imagine just stripping them off the bone with your fingers. If you wait until it just naturally happens, it's too late. You got to get them at the point where you can handle it, where you could grab a little chunk of the, because the meat retracts and leaves little bone ends out there. You want it at the point where you could grab one of those bone ends and lift the whole thing up and have it not fall apart. But that if you wanted to tear it apart, you could. That is the moment to strike. In a pressure cooker, that moment lasts for minutes. In a slow cooker, that moment lasts for a long time.
Yeah.
That's a large window to shoot for.
Well, we did some the other day, and I want to say it was right at 4 hours, 3.5, 4 hours, and we felt like, had we not caught it right then and there, we had a lot of other stuff going on, and so we checked them. We're like, oh, it's fork tender right now. But they were at the far end of fork tender.
Yeah.
They were getting ready to start falling off the bone.
And you'll notice, too, that you've rendered a lot of that tallow out because of the liquid. The surface of the liquid is going to be very oily.
And that's really my question here is, and where I get tripped up and end up just saying, screw it and cooking the whole thing is...
Cooking what whole thing?
The ribs. Like, I just... It's not even worth trimming off any fat because I can't get to all the fat, right? Because there's so many layers in there, right?
Yeah.
And that's
why I'm just saying, like, do it a rough once over.
Yeah.
And I don't know why I do a rough once over, but this is easy to do.
Gotcha.
So you're saying you just rendered out anyways, and because some of the fat's all right if it's hot. The next step, pull them out of the liquid, lay them on a tray, and let them dry a little bit. Drain off and dry. Now you hit them with your favorite dry rub. Right? Then you walk over to your grill, your outdoor grill, and you throw them on your outdoor grill, and all you're really doing is warming them up and putting a little char on them. They're already cooked and ready to eat. And you take a mop, you take a half cup of cider vinegar, a half cup of yellow mustard, mix that up, throw them on your grill, and baste them with the vinegar cider, the vinegar mustard mop until they just start to char up and get all nice and warm, and then you eat them. And you will never discard another rib the rest of your life. And you will hate the man that does.
Love it.
Even call him
dude,
stupid.
It's so... Yeah, you will call him stupid and hate him.
Now, I
is
have,
that good?
I have left some deer ribs in the woods. Just the they're each. You've said it before. You know, every animal, wild game animal, is its own beast. It's different. And I've the deer I got this year. Like that was a giant the rib. Section alone was a ton of meat, and that definitely came out with me. But you know, Montana, you know, very end of the season, some buck that's just been rutting like crazy, and that rib meat looks like jerky. About it's almost done jerky,
and there's nothing on the outside of it.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah. There's no. I don't think there's any state where you like all the states have. Most states have what's called salvage requirements or wanton waste laws. And they spell out for you what you need to keep.
Yeah. When I first moved to Idaho, you had to keep the rib meat.
Is that right?
And you had to keep the neck meat. And then they changed that law. And, you know, myself and my group of buddies that I hunt with were just wickedly pissed. Just because that is phenomenal eating.
I think in general, salvage requirements should be much stricter.
I agree.
They should be spelled out. It's fun. I love to read them because of how specific some states are. I think generally they should be more. I think it generally be good for hunters, good for hunting, and good for public perception to have much stricter salvage requirements.
Yeah, the optics of it would be good.
One day, this happened a million years ago, but one day I was really upset about some things that I had seen other hunters do and was really upset. And me and Yanni were driving down the road. You remember this?
Yeah.
And we look, and there's an elk gut pile laying out in a field.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm all mad about something.
But you had to preface this that we were talking about, you're upset, and you're like, yeah, this is just not right. I forget what you were upset about. Maybe, was it just flock shooting elk or something?
Some guys had gotten onto a herd of elk and were using text messaging where it's not allowed. We're using text messaging to like coordinate efforts on a herd of elk.
Right. And somehow we got to talking about taking stuff out of the field, and you were like, yeah, my dad, you know, and this, that, and the other, we took everything out.
Like, my dad would go check other dudes' gut piles to get the heart.
Yeah. And I'm saying, like, I didn't grow up that way. Even though I grew up hunting a lot, like, I didn't grow up. Like, nobody taught me, like, and plus, we, like, just dropped our deer off at the processor. But, like, I didn't know about shanks and neck meat and hearts and livers. And sure, we ate, like, heart and liver, like, one night, and that was usually the night of opener in Wisconsin. We'd have, like, a meal of that. But that was it. Like, if I shot a deer some other time of year, like, it just, that didn't come home with
us.
So, anyways, yeah, we're driving down the road. We see a gut pile.
And I jump out all in a huff and go running out in the field to go get the heart. And the heart's gone.
Because you're like, I guarantee those sons of bitches left it out here.
Yeah, and the guy had the heart. The guy had taken the heart, and then I got back in all back in a good mood.
Nobody would hunt that way.
And be a heart man.
Right.
But then I was like, yeah, those guys are all right.
I got in a little debate with my uncle about that particular instance.
The one I'm talking about.
Yeah. And he was like, you know, people got to eat. That's getting groceries. Bruh, bruh, bruh. And I said, yeah, but because of the use of illegal communication, I feel that the scale just tipped way out of whack, right? Just went way too far to the hunter's advantage versus the game's advantage, and that's just not the way the system's supposed to operate.
And in that location, it's not open to your individual interpretation because it's just against the law.
True.
Like it or not, that state has made that not legal.
Yep.
Listening to this, it's like, it seems like more hunters need to make the connection to the food end of it to elevate that, because you're talking about the tongue and the neck and the shank and the ribs and these things. Most people are just discarding this, which if you know how to take care of that, it's some of the best eaten.
Some of the best stuff.
You know, and is it just because a lot of hunters just want to grind sausage and want burger meat? Does it need to come in education of how to take care of those cuts and make them so delicious to eat? I mean,
I think education is a big part of it.
And was a game warden telling you or me about how, this is in Montana, but he said, you know, 3 years ago, he never saw deer come through check stations that still had shanks.
And what happened to them?
They'd leave them in the field. Yeah, but now he feels like almost no shanks get left in the field.
I had a game warden from a western state come up to me, and she's like, I feel that because of your show, I honestly feel that because of your show, I see better field care.
How cool is that?
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's it. I mean, that's the end goal, right?
And she said, I feel like it's been a marked difference.
That's awesome.
To begin like having conversations about this stuff.
It comes down to work, though.
Yeah, it's worth
it. I mean, you're like, when you're talking about the difference between what I used to do to get an elk out of the woods and what I do now, like more weight on your back, more time spent at the carcass, you know, more time spent at the butchering table at home. Like, it just...
Yeah. You'd be surprised how many people are like picky little kids, though. My kids aren't that way. My kids aren't picky little kids, but a lot of grown-ups are just like squeamish, picky eaters.
Mm.
Like their parents indulged that when they were a kid or something, and now they're like, you know, I'm not gonna eat that. Like, they honestly sound like that.
Yeah, my kids are kind of mad when I bring home little 4 or 5 inch ribs off, like, the, like, if you cut the rib slab and into thirds and stuff. They like it if I just like leave whole it rib. The whole thing whole. Like that, they just have such a more enjoyable dinner when they just have like the giant bone in hand and they're gnawing and pulling. They love it.
Yeah. So I think there's that. It's like being like a little picky, squeamish person.
And what he just said about laziness. I mean, I guess it's
extra work.
It's just, you think if you were out there in that whole experience that you would just try and get every little ounce out of it, but I guess not everybody's wired like that, huh?
No, and then there's the other thing, too. It's just, like, hard to learn how to do it. So yeah. It's really, but here's the thing. If you become a good hunter, that's hard.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's hard to be a good hunter.
Yeah.
So if you have it in your brain to become a good hunter, which is extremely difficult, you definitely have it in your brain to learn how to do, like, a handful of procedures on how to cook.
Right. Yeah, it makes sense.
But you're right. You see, and it's funny because hunting, like, you can't divorce hunting from its roots. Hunting is a, like, hunting owes its history, owes its inception to the fact that it was a food gathering method.
Correct.
It's like a food gathering strategy. And still today, if you go hunt with, you know, certain indigenous cultures, they have absolutely no waste. In certain, you know, depending, right. That's a blanket statement. There's also cases where people have driven off, you know, 800 buffalo off a cliff and then butchered a dozen of them and then the rest rotted because they probably were surprised as well that 800 went over there. They were just hoping to get a couple. So, I mean, there's times when that's not the case, but like generally it's like food acquisition and wide utilization. When we spent time down in South America, they don't flay fish. They cook fish whole and suck every bone.
Mm-hmm.
So when they're done, there's a little teeny pile of glistening bones laying there.
That's amazing.
Head, every single thing, right? Hunting like takes its heritage from that, but at some point in time, in some people's minds, it got like divorced from food acquisition.
Yeah.
I'll talk to guys, be like, big time hunter guys. I know they got a bunch of meat in the freezer, and you talk to them, they're cooking something different.
Boneless, skinless chicken breast because it fits into my workout routine.
I'm like you of all people, but you of all people are cooking chicken tonight. $4 or $5 in the freezer. Oh, man.
Yeah. Well, where are you at, Pooter, on your... would you prefer I call you Andrew for this? Sorry about that.
You can call me whatever you want.
What? Because, I mean, I definitely got into food. Really, the separation between just enjoying eating food and actually cooking my own food. Because a combination of single parent home and having game meat in the freezer. So it was like, I could eat something out of a can or I could dig something out of the freezer, right? Mm-hmm. But you told me today that you haven't been, or you very limited on the big game hunting side of things.
Yeah, yeah. I did not grow up hunting, but food was a big part of kind of growing up and family holidays and that. So that's kind of the route that I got into food. But the experiences that I've had with hunting are mostly with the Ranellas and this kind of crew, which I learned kind of later, you know, probably in my late 20s, I kind of started getting into with you guys. And that experience was just first being out, you know, in the wilderness and having that whole experience. It was just over the top. But for me, the second that animal got down on the ground, it just excited me so much to be able to see it start to come apart. And instantly in my mind, I'm thinking, okay, I can see that loin. I can see that rump roast. And in preparations in my mind and the people that I was going to share it with, I mean, that was the most exhilarating thing to me that drew me into it is the fact that I can go do this on my own and then be able to turn it into something pretty good and then to be able to share it with everybody else. I think that's really what drew me in.
Yeah, and I don't think you ever saw it as anything, even like with fish. Not that you don't enjoy fishing, but I feel like for you, the link, the food.
Yeah.
The fishing, hunting, food link, it was never like a thing that you sort of like discovered later.
Yeah.
It's like, I don't, like with you, I feel like you always viewed it as a food thing.
Big time, big time. But the experience that comes along with it is just like the biggest bonus there is, because it's, you know, it's an amazing experience to get out there. But yeah, with fishing, I have friends that fish that don't really like to eat fish that much. And it, I'm like, well, why are you out there? You know?
I was wondering the same thing. There's a guy I know that I've met him a couple times. I heard about this aspect of someone else, but he's a duck hunting fool. You know, I think he hunts 40, 50 days every duck season, will not eat a duck. But to his credit, he's cultivated like a large group of people. He's cultivated a lot of friends in an immigrant community near where he lives who love duck. And that's a thing that he does.
Sure.
He is very careful about getting the ducks, getting them gutted, and bringing them to the people that he knows want the meat and use it well. Yeah. But I just wonder, like, how could it be, like, what gets you up in the morning?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, look at fly fishing. I hate to harp on the fly fishermen, but like thousands of trout caught by some of these folks every summer, and
no one's eating them
for the most part. No.
Yeah, no, that's true. Yeah, so he gets up in the morning and does it. But I kind of think also it's like he's probably bringing like a class of food. He's bringing like a class of food to someone who might not be able to afford that food. We got another friend down in South Texas who has a network of people that he brings wild pig to. Mm-hmm. And he said to us, if I wasn't bringing them pig, they're not eating meat.
Well, not just wild pig, but wasn't all those does that he has to
some
shoot
venison
off
too. That might have been. Yeah, and I remember him saying, this isn't like that they prefer this over the stuff they buy in the store. He's like, it's this or it's not. It's nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Which is hard to argue with.
Mm-hmm. And the fact, just like going down, you know, to the fish market and looking at that piece of halibut and knowing if I want 2 pounds of halibut to have a few friends over for the night, that I'm going to be paying, you know, upwards of $100. I mean, I know you spend the money and the gas and lure and all that, but it's, man, it's just so much more rewarding and enjoyable to be able to have that kind of quantity to share.
No, it's the most rewarding thing in the world, man.
Well, and you're living the good life, man. If you go, if you're, you know, and it doesn't take that much. I was talking to somebody else about this recently, about like what it actually takes if you don't own a fish shack, but to go to Southeast Alaska on like a very, you know, purpose-driven trip to be like, okay, we want to like bring home a bunch of salmon and whatever else we can catch and whatnot. And you could probably do it for not that. It's not exorbitant, you know, if you don't go stay at a fancy fishing lodge.
No, you market value, you're going to end up ahead of the game.
Yeah.
With the
But again, I feel like the exercise of it and the act of it, I mean, that's like really enriching your life.
You're doubling down, right? I mean, you're simultaneously paying for your food and your recreation with the same dollar. So
that's the funny thing that the conversation I have is that people are like, well, you ever imagine what that costs per pound? It's like, okay, let's figure out. You just went to Paris. You didn't bring shit home to eat from Paris. So what's that cost? It's like, what's that cost per pound? It's like, at least, like if you play golf, no one's like, well, what that cost per unit? It's like you don't even have a thing to begin measuring.
They don't even factor in their beers.
At least I got 20 pounds of fish where you can begin having the conversation about something I got home for it. But no one presses a golfer every time he walks in to justify his outing based on what he brought home with him.
Yeah.
He didn't bring home anything with him except that he like lost 2 golf balls.
Yeah.
So like don't bust his balls about what it's cost him. But you go out and like bring a fish and be like, well, yeah, but what did it cost you per pound? I was like, what'd you do today? Like, what do you have to show for what you did today? At least I got something.
Yes. And that is, I think that's the root of like my hesitation when, because, and I'm sure you guys have been there too, like, we got a lot of guys, you know, you're kind of like, hey, catching up. And I'm like, man, yeah, I'm fretting because I got this going on and this going on. And, well, hey, man, I got a bunch of elk in the freezer, so don't worry about it if you don't make it out. I was like, yeah, I don't want to eat your elk, man. Because, you know, I want to be out there doing it more than anything. So,
oh, there's that aspect of it, man, is like, I wouldn't. It's fun for me to cook for my family, and it's fun for me to cook for my friends. It's fun for me to cook for myself because, like, we went and got it.
Yeah.
That's the value. I would not do the things I do if it wasn't that way. I would never be like all excited to cook something I bought at Whole Foods for people the way I get all excited to be like, check that out, man. Because it's a damn mountain lion.
it's directly tied to the experience every single time, you know?
Yeah, we were talking earlier, you know, you get to relive that experience and tell that story. And I'll tell you what, man, I've been digging into that elk from a fog neck. And that's a hell of a story you're telling every time. You're like, yeah, we could have just left the other half there after that incident. But we climbed up in that tree, got the other 400 pounds, and then walked it out of there. That's an intense story.
Yeah, I was just telling a story the other day when we were up North Slope, you know, to somebody that has no idea what that's all about. And it's you just keep reliving it over and over and over, you know?
Yeah, up caribou hunting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Meat's long gone now, though.
Meat's long gone.
Stories live on.
They do.
Andrew, do you feel like when you're shoulder to shoulder with any of the Ranella boys or whoever who's more on the hunting aspect as opposed to somebody who spends each and every day 8-10 hours a day in a kitchen, do you think you're approaching any of these cuts, the critter itself, whatever it may be, in a much different way?
No, I mean, hanging out with you guys for years, phenomenal the way that you guys cook up some of this stuff, you know? I mean, and you have a nice base knowledge of how, because game meat is different than cooking domestic animal. I mean, it just hands down. You're talking about more fat. You're talking about, you know, the game being a lot leaner. So it is, I think it's a great relationship of give and take as far as you guys have such a understanding of how to use the game meat in its proper way, where sometimes then maybe I'll come in and put a technique down that's a little fancied up a little bit, you know?
That's the way I look at it. Like, I know...
Like, I think we're learning from each other.
Oh, yeah, because I'm not, like, you're 1,000 times better, like, you're 1,000 times better at cooking and just chefing than I am. What I know is I just have had a lot of experiences with a lot of different types of game.
Yeah.
And I kind of know its attributes.
Yeah.
And know the general, like, approach to take with different parts of different game animals and, like, what sorts of things it could be used for. That's what I know that's not easily replicated unless you've been exposed to the things I've been exposed to. But the actual details of, like, assembling dishes...
Yeah.
I just don't know like you know. That's why it's fun for me to cook with you.
Yeah, and vice versa. Like,
I'll be like, you know what's good to do with these loins is you, like, sear them and throw them in the oven. And then you'll go do that, and you'll make a cauliflower puree and pickled red on. You know, I mean, like, all the stuff that goes with it. And I'm like, now that, like, holy shit. I would never have come up with that. But what I did know is that this piece of meat.
Yeah. And it's fun.
Tends to be, like, best when prepared this sort of way.
It's fun because a lot of times, like, I'll let you kind of take that lead on how to use that particular cut. And then I know the technique of how to then take it and elevate it to a different level, you know?
But I think the reason you're such a good ground up, like, you're a good chef with seafood is because it's stuff you've been dealt with professionally for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it doesn't matter. You catch a halibut. Halibut doesn't matter if you caught it or bought it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So you can, like, really learn all about fish. The way you can't really learn all about what you're looking at when you're looking at a, like, different three dead deer laying on the woods, the you know, laying on the ground out in the woods. I look at them, I'm seeing something that you're only going to see after having had a lot of experience about, like, what's the difference between all those things laying there.
Yeah.
But, like, actually cooking, I kind of, like, I'm not really good at actually cooking.
You hold your own.
Yeah, I mean, I can, like, cook, like, family style cooking, you know, but not, like, restaurant style cooking.
But see, that's where I think the whole hunting experience came in that got me so excited, is because a lot of times in commercial kitchens, you're not getting whole animals in. You're getting cuts in that, you know, are broken down. You're getting your primals and your subprimals, but to actually see the whole animal, especially in its state from, you know, tracking it for days and being out there in its environment, and then to see it on the ground and then start to break down. I think everybody that eats meat should at some point see that process.
Just to get it.
Yeah.
I find myself stressing, and I was just writing this actually in the introduction to our forthcoming Wild Game Cookbook. I was writing about, particularly with big game, is I'm always pushing a cut-based approach to cooking wild game, to cooking big game. Because you'll find that you put up like a, you put up a recipe, like, here's a great, here's a way to prepare heart. And people are like, oh, I see you had a thing up about elk heart, but do you have a moose heart recipe? I think a lot of hunters tend to like look at, they stress too much like what the animal is, when it's more important to know what part of the animal you're eating. I don't approach, if I'm like cooking shank, I don't think differently about an antelope shank, a mountain goat shank, a whitetail shank, a mule deer shank, an elk shank, javelina is a little small, a wild pig shank. I tend to think more like what's more important to me, not the animal that it was. I don't really care. I want to know what it was. And all my, like, my wild game cooking is all based off the cut, not like what it is.
Yeah.
Like when you open up a big game cookbook and they have like elk recipes, and then you go and you flip and, oh, here's moose recipes. I'm like, dude, there's no difference between an elk recipe and a moose recipe.
Yeah. Sure, there's going to be flavor profile differences, I think, from meat to meat to meat, but I don't think it's to the point where really you need to change the recipe.
No.
Sure, you can adjust it and you might have your favorites, but for the most part.
Yeah. What you're talking about is knowing how to cook. And like, yeah. You know the techniques.
Exactly. How to handle these different pieces. And you're right. There's going to be difference between elk and moose, but there's also going to be difference from one moose to the next.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's something that's like special about the wild game, that sort of like, you should be like, not instead of trying to cover that up, but you make the same recipe and you're kind of like, oh yeah, you taste that difference in the caribou, mm-hmm. or you taste that difference. Maybe you taste like the willow and the moose and the caribou. You're sort of tasting that lichen or whatever other North Slope browse he was eating on. And in the white-tailed deer, you taste like the acorn and the corn and the soybeans. Well,
that's the GMO. You taste the GMOs.
That is the bridge between the hunter and the chef, though, right? I mean, to know all the way back to the environment that you pull that animal out of, knowing that the down the line that the flavor profile is going to be different.
Yeah, know? But that's stuff that comes like almost after the recipe.
Sure.
After the method of preparation. There are, like, I don't want to oversimplify this, because let's just say you're talking about like the difference between whitetails and mule deer. Sure, there are fundamental differences between whitetail and mule deer, but those differences might not be as extreme. Those inherent differences might not be as extreme as the difference between one whitetail and another whitetail.
Mm-hmm.
If you were able to sort of like apply a number system to like quantify differences, a half-starved 4-year-old mule deer that just was hung up on a barbed wire fence and got hamstrung by a coyote and then kind of healed up, but he's not doing real well. Like, there's that animal. And then there's some 2-year-old mule deer that's been hanging out in an alfalfa field. Those are very different animals. The difference between those two things is so much more extreme than the difference between a whitetail and a mule deer.
Right.
It's just like, so that's all after the fact. I just think that like in cooking, you got to learn like, what is it that you have?
Mm-hmm.
When I was a kid, we cut up deer. We cut up steaks, which included the backstrap, tenderloin, and most of the rounds and sirloins from the back legs. And then the rest was burger. Unless we made jerky. So we would get done, and all that whole damn deer would say two things. Steaks, burger. That was how I was brought up to cut deer. I now have a much more nuanced approach to it.
Sure. And that just comes from experience, right?
The willingness to have experiences.
Mm-hmm.
There are many, many people out there that, and I still hang out with some that it's like, no, that's the way you do it.
Steaks and burgers.
Yeah. It's like, there is no, what's the difference? There is no difference. Like, I eat Hamburger Helper. It all goes into Hamburger Helper.
I'd rather some dude be eating his whole deer as Hamburger Helper than some dude sort of watching it in his freezer, uneasily feeling kind of like vaguely guilty about it for 3 years, waiting for when he gets to go pitch it because it's freezer burned. Dude, I don't look down on any kind of cooking.
Me neither.
As long as it's wild game cooking, I'm open to it all. Put, you want to throw one last plug in? How do folks find you?
Well, at this point, we're kind of on a small level up there on the island. And I don't
because you got your main chef and job.
Yeah. So the catering is just kind of a side project.
Yeah, but it's fun, and people would love it.
I absolutely love it. Yeah.
If you want to hire a guy that you can actually hang out with and learn a thing or two from.
Yeah.
Instead of some dingbat caterer.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, summertime is kind of the high season up there. And if anybody's talking about San Juan Island, so it's a small population of people. So it's kind of a tight little community, but it's also a pretty popular destination for tourists. So there are a bit of events up there that get the need for catering. So, yeah, On Island Time Catering. And right now, we're just kind of getting it off the ground. So if you went to the Chamber of Commerce, you'd find us pretty easy.
And the other thing is, if you hunt and fish and ever wanted to have someone come and do small party events where someone who really has the know-how comes and shows you just what is possible with your stuff.
Could take that boring old venison steak.
How to like really do amazing stuff with your wild game for you and your friends. I would look them up too.
Also, I believe,
he's my favorite cook.
He's single as well. So like,
and he's single.
Yeah. I finally get to do it to somebody else.
And he's single. And he's available.
From one single guy to another.
The most eligible bachelor of the Pacific. Let's just expand it to the Pacific Northwest.
Perfect for that
the
ladies'
most
lunch.
Charismatic, eligible bachelor of the Pacific Northwest who also cooks.
Yeah. And if you live closer to the Intermountain Rocky, what am I trying to say?
The Intermountain Rocky Mountain West.
Intermountain West. Oh, yeah. Cal is available there.
Most eligible bachelor of the Inner Rocky Mountain West.
And I can lift things and carry them. So. Do you have a specialty? Like if
he's a saucier. He's a saucier.
In my personal endeavors.
You mean in love, you talking about love life or cooking?
That one's up to you. You can take it whatever
you
want.
It's called the Poop Magooch.
I really like cooking seafood a lot.
You live on an island out in the ocean.
Yeah. And it's just so delicate. And then if it's handled right, man, it's just so good.
Anything in particular in the seafood world?
Well, I think just out of the fact that I end up with a lot of it every year is the heavy hitters, halibut, salmon, prawns,
lingcod,
and I think pound for pound lingcod stands up against anything. I think it's one of my favorite fish. But
if I
also
could only eat one fish the rest of my life and they told me it had to be lingcod, I'd be like, cool.
Yeah,
that's cool, bro.
Yeah, if it's done right, it stands up against just about anything.
Wow.
But I also like kind of just doing the fun projects. Making sausage, on a Saturday afternoon, just putzing around the house and having a big cut of meat in the smoker or raising something down. Those are fun days to be able to just kind of have a leisurely pace at it and play with something all afternoon, And then be able to, like I said a few times, but be able to share it. That's my biggest thing is to lucky enough to, that it is my profession, but it's to be able to share those experiences and have people actually enjoy, what I've produced. You make a million little masterpieces that disappear, right? I think about, the whole span of my career, it's like,
there ain't nothing left. It's all gone.
Every time. Every time. You think about architects, or you think about, people that build stuff, and it's artists that hangs for a million years. Every day you're building tiny little masterpieces that might take you 3-4 weeks and just snap, like that's gone. You know?
I never really thought about it that way, but you're right. But when you're doing like your like 8-step duck pastrami and all of a sudden it's just gone, you're like, son of a bitch.
Yeah, and there's sometimes, they ate that, sometimes that I come at things that I almost don't want to, you know, like that the perfect stock that, you know, that I made one a couple weeks ago. Just this, it was a beef stock, but then I cooked it down. I mean, it was days and days and days, and I got this thing down to a demi-glace where I started with 12 gallons and I got it down to just, you know, a cup full, and I just like covered it. I didn't want to use it for anything because it was like, this is a masterpiece in itself. But that's where the reward is seeing people that you know that enjoy it, because it is, it's gone. Every day you do it and it's gone.
I'm going through that right now where I have two pieces of sable fish in my freezer,
and you just want to hold on.
What
and
is I'd sable like fish?
Black cod.
Oh, okay.
And I like knowing they're in my freezer more than I like eating them, because I like eating them so much.
Yeah,
I like knowing they're in there, and I find myself like, I catch myself opening my freezer and staring at my two big pieces of sable fish, being like, "Fellas should probably eat them. They ain't getting better. They ain't getting better in there, you know."
But then you're just waiting for the perfect scenario, right? Yeah. You're waiting for the right people to come over and the right preparation on it to make them.
No, I got a plan for them.
Yeah.
I got a plan for them.
It's called lunch today, right?
Nope. No, I got my my brothers and their wives and whatnot are coming for Christmas. Right. Coming for Christmas.
Yeah.
Yanni? Anything to add?
Closing thought. Yeah, I was thinking about how...
can I interrupt you?
Yeah.
How you liking that brand spickety new First Light?
Loving it.
What do you guys call that, a heli? What do they call those things?
Henley.
Henley, yep. That's a sweet piece.
Top secret, though, isn't it?
No, man, we can talk about her now. But you wore that in Colorado, right?
Love it.
Yeah, it is. Yeah,
it's a little bit thicker. It's got some spandex?
No, that one is 100% wool. The wool on the inside is just fleeced.
Oh, is that what it is? Which, it's probably as thick as a slice of bread, Matt. Love that thing.
Though. It's little old school wool technology that we stole from the Swedish military, I think. Oh yeah, now you're good. 5%? That's nothing. That's just
you're right, Yanni.
You were.
Well, no, yeah. But I think it serves a purpose. You guys didn't put it in there for shits and giggles.
Well, you got squid ink on this thing?
No, my kids were painting ornaments the other day and then showing them to me, and I didn't know that they had just finished painting the ornaments, and so I've got paint on my phone and obviously on this shirt too.
Okay, yeah. Correction: this new Henley is I think 400 weight merino. And there's 5% spandex in there, because one thing that we dislike from tromping in the woods with pure merino is how it kind of bags out on the sleeves.
Yeah.
Over the course of a week. You know?
Yeah. Do you feel like it's going to help in the durability too?
Yeah.
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 So it's got just a little more like spring, a little more snap to it, where you feel like, it's not going to get that sort of like loose bagginess.
You don't want to run home and wash it so it puckers back up again.
Yeah,
right.
That's what I call it, is the re-pucker it.
The re-pucker, yeah. And, you know, a big thing that, I mean, you guys do for us, and I try to get as many days in myself, is trying to explore the new items and see if they're actually doing the things that we want them to do in the field, because they're just, you can't recreate that stuff.
This thing's killing it for podcasting in Steve's chili garage.
It's just perfect podcast and outfit, man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, and it's, how do you test that? You have a podcast.
Just got to do a marathon sesh.
Yeah.
You got to get poot down here and start going on it. Kelly, got any... Oh, yeah, did you get a chance? I interrupted you to ask you about your shirt.
Yeah.
I was admiring how attractive you look over
we're
there.
We're getting close to being out of time. But you were talking about how you try to eat a bunch of fish during fishing or right after fishing season and sort of... You know, by this time of year, now it's like late fall, you're sort of getting over eating fish, right? Because you've been eating a whole bunch of fish.
Because I don't like to leave in my freezer as long as, like, red meat, I just leave in there forever, but yeah. I like to...
But I've had the same thing happen with red meat, you know, like where I just had like the main thing in my freezer, I had like two elk, you know, and I'd maybe had another whatever, but for most part, I've just been eating elk and elk and elk and elk. And for us, I'd really like to eat only wild game. You can definitely get bored where you're like, man, just just need something to switch it up. And I was thinking about that, and the answer is to be like the Steven Rinella generalist hunter.
Yes.
And like this year, I'm like, all right, kind of had it in my head. I put it out there to the universe. I was like, I need some ducks. Then my buddy calls. He's like, dude, you want to go duck hunting? I got a sweet spot. So we roll in, boom, some ducks. So I've got like 10 ducks in my freezer.
Critical.
You'll find that Giannis talks about putting something out to the universe. And what that means is he feels as though...
if you're thinking about it...
It's kind of like a Lavian...
it's not Lavian.
It's Lavian metaphysics. Is that just by letting it... Just feeling a way and letting people know a way that you thing that you desire.
Is it personal manifestation? People use that; they throw that term.
Yeah. So Yanni's like, by he just exudes a feeling of wanting ducks.
Uh huh.
And if he exudes that strong enough, the phone will ring, and it, in this case, it did, and he now has a whole bunch of ducks. Now you got a sack full of squid.
My buddy Miller uses that for work.
When he needs work,
really slowing down, he's sort of like, it's like, hey, universe needs some work. Bring 10,000 square feet, yin. He's a tile guy, so 10,000 square foot house.
There's a lot of tile.
Yeah,
a lot of tile.
But yeah, that's really helped me for like keeping on the 100% wild game, you know, menu and being excited about it is like having some fish, some squirrels, some rabbits, some ducks, some elk.
The generalist hunter and angler is a well-fed mofo.
Yeah. And people like to only be like the, you know, big game, you know, white big buck whitetail deer hunter, where you just, you know, expand a little bit, man. It really opens up your menu, diversifies it.
You can only stuff so much variety into a sausage casing.
Mm-hmm. Cal, you got any final thoughts? I don't have any.
Can you guys tackle for me? Just put this thing to bed, my mule deer neck scenario.
Oh.
I think you can do that in 2 minutes. I have this a whole mule deer neck. I wanted to wrap it in the call fat, in a beautiful big call fat, and roast it on the pellet grill. That's what I intended to do. And to give you guys the full story is... you know, it was a really tricky, steep spot when I was trying to get that neck out. A lot of the blood out of the cavity came out and actually, like, gave the neck a real, about half of it, a good bloodshot appearance. So I took it home when I got home and basically just put it in a very simple brine. I think I just kind of threw some odds and ends in there, but, you know, salt, water were the really the main ingredients. So I don't think there's going to be any other leftovers. But now it looks clean and beautiful again. And it's thawing out right now. Took it out before I came here to Seattle.
I wouldn't do it the way you're talking about doing it.
It would be an experiment.
I wouldn't do it that way. I think you could do it in a pellet grill. The neck. But I wouldn't wrap it up in anything. I would do it in a pellet grill and be basting the living daylights out of that thing.
But think of the loss of heat on the pellet grill, though.
I'm saying what I would do with it. And yeah. I would devise a dish, like tacos or something, where I was shaving the neck meat off the outside, the nice smoky neck meat off the outside, and making some, and then shaving some more and making some. If you want to have me, you're going to serve that whole damn neck. You're going to need to braise that neck down. And you're going to need to take that neck and sear it on, like, give it a good rub. Get a gigantic pan, sear the whole thing all over the place, put it in a giant pot with a tight-fitting lid, and put it in your oven at 300 degrees for a ton of hours, or in a slow cooker until you can pick it.
Because you feel like it's just going to dry out on the grill?
It needs tender. A moist method for sure.
It's not going to be tender.
You could almost do it in reverse. Like if you did the moist method first, so if you braised it to where you're almost getting to, like you're talking about the ribs, where it's still going to hold together, but it's tender, and then put it into a smoker or a grill where then you could kind of infuse a little bit of that smoky flavor.
Oh. That is called the poot magoon.
And there,
that's now you're thinking, that's a good idea, Pooter.
And yeah. There, if you wrapped it in the call fat.
Yeah. Yeah,
then that's just going to melt. Right,
it would melt, but it would also, if you were getting too tender and it was starting to fall apart, it would act as
hold it.
Because I don't think I can put it in. I don't think I can get it in the oven. Because I mean, this And it's got to be a 15-pound.
Mm. Even if you took...
you know what you need is one of those little electric roasting ovens.
I do need a roasting oven.
I might have one I could send you.
Even if you took a rack out, you couldn't get it in a pan in there? Maybe,
I could, but it wouldn't be a pan that has a lid at that point.
Aluminum foil.
Weston electric roaster.
Sealed tightly as you can.
All right. You think that's the way to go, Andrew?
Braise it. Braise it until it's just right there, then pull it out if you want to infuse that flavor. Then you could almost let it cool till you could work it, wrap it in your call.
Give it a good rub down.
And then put it on your...
I'd rub it down with, at a minimum, salt and pepper, maybe even something a lot zippier.
Because this then is a wrap visual that thing, right? Gun up.
Yeah.
It's a visual... Because I want that Fred Flintstone mega roast is...
Yeah. Yeah.
I think Poot's idea.
But
Island time, bro.
You'd have to pull it out before it falls apart. Just kind of like you're saying with the ribs.
Yeah.
But then you won't.
300? Because when I cook those necks down, when I cook a neck down, I'll cook it down and make like barbecue sandwiches with
it. Me too, yeah.
I'll cook it down until it looks like you could shake that neck and a bunch of vertebra fall out of there. It look like something out of a museum.
Yeah.
I mean, you can cook it down to where that meat, where you can just grab off fistfuls of meat off that neck rolls.
Right.
So don't let that happen.
What did I just ask?
About how to cook your neck.
Yeah.
If I was paying attention, right?
All right. I think I got it.
You good?
You think you'd go call Fat then? Or just sure, save that for something else? All right.
No, why not?
Yeah, give her a shot.
It'd be fun. All right. Eat your deer meat. Eat all kinds of meat. Let's take care of it first. Cook it nice. Thanks for listening.